You'll pray with me. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ, Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Bliss. Amen. It's highly fitting that we sang the song, I am He. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Because today we're going to talk about purification and temptation, and Master sang this song when he took the vows to become a Swami. And in his saying, mind nor intellect nor ego have I, he is affirming what realized souls know. One time when I was driving off of the ferry from the Swanson Ferry up in Canada, there's a pumpkin field out in a distance, and I could see all these pumpkins in their ripeness out there, and I thought of them as all these little orange flames out in the field. And then the thought came to me that the reason that why Swamis wear the orange color is because it symbolizes the inner fire. The inner fire of renunciation, the inner fire of Kundalini. And the Kundalini purifies the body, the mind, the intellect, and makes us prepared to be instruments of the divine consciousness. As Master explains in the Autobiography of a Yogi, unless you are prepared for it physically, mentally, in all ways, and you were to be given the uplifting experience, that it would literally fry your nerves. Your mind would not be able to contain it all. Remember the story of Ramakrishna when he gave the touch to Vivekananda before he became Swami Vivekananda, his Narendra. And he gave him the touch on the heart, and he began to feel this swirling sensation that was beginning to lift him up. And he's saying, what did you do to me? What did you do to me? Make it stop. And so Ramakrishna made it stop. And he didn't feel that he was prepared for that experience at that time. And Ramakrishna said, you'll have this experience later on. And when you do, you'll leave the body. And so he had a relatively short life of it, but he had a very dynamic life. And he made a lot of things happen, as great souls can oftentimes do in a short amount of time. And I'd like to read from our lesson of purification, temptation. Quoting from St. John, and now also the axe is laid to the root of the trees. Therefore, every tree which bringeth forth not good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. I indeed baptize you with water unto repentance. But he that cometh after me is mightier than I, whose shoes I am not worthy to bear. He shall baptize you with the Holy Ghost and with fire, whose fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly purge his floor and gather his wheat into the garner. But he will burn up the chaff with unquenchable fire. Now this unquenchable fire that's talked about here I've been on intimate terms with for the almost going on 40 years now, when it first started in me. And it's a wonderful thing, but it's also a terrible thing in the sense that it can stretch us, it can stress us, it can create a tremendous sensation inside when this unquenchable fire begins to burn inside. And it came originally with a tremendous power up through the spine and to the third eye point. And I felt the tremendous heat of it at the time. And it's continued in one form or another from that time till this. And that unquenchable fire continues to consume. It consumes what John the Baptist talked about here, whose fan is in his hand. A fan is a winnowing fan. It's for separating the chaff from the wheat kernels. And it's thrown up into the air, and the wind will blow away the lighter chaff. But the kernels will remain, and that's how you separate out the two. And then after you're done with it, you gather up all the chaff and you throw it into the fire. And the fire consumes it. So the kernel is that part that is pure God within you. And the chaff that's blown away and then burned is everything that is not of God, all idea of separation, all sense of separation. And so this is an absolutely necessary process to go through in order to come to that complete state of realization. And if you do not go through it, if you're not willing to go through this, then you can't enter into the higher realms. From Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, I'd like to read from verse 6. This is chapter 2. The individual who forcibly controls the organs of action, but whose mind rotates around the thoughts of sense objects, is said to be a hypocrite, deluding himself. That's Krishna speaking. And Master says, he who subdues his senses outwardly and not inwardly, as might a recluse who renounces worldly pleasures but continually broods over objects of his deprivation, is self-deluded and living a lie. A false sense of assurance and self-sufficiency will allow temptation to catch him off guard. And this is absolutely true. If we withhold from the outer senses and think that we're doing something great and that we're actually purifying the mind, and yet inwardly we're always dwelling on the things that we have kept ourselves from indulging in, then we are really fooling ourselves. We're not really on the spiritual path yet. That is what Jesus called a hypocrite. When Papa began to his life as a renunciant, he was already chanting almost 24 hours of the day, the Ram Nam, and he would feel the bliss of God. Doesn't mean that he didn't have any temptation along the way, but he was so filled with this positive attraction towards God, this filling up with bliss. And it was simply through chanting the name of God, Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. And as he chanted it, he felt the vibration inside of him, and he felt the bliss springs begin to open up. And he was taken into the higher realms, into the heavenly kingdom. And through that experience, he finally got the inner injunction that he must leave his family. Now, to test that spirit, because we are told to test each spirit, he opened up the three chapters from the three scriptures that he read from. And he read from the Bhagavad Gita. And there, Krishna talked about renouncing the world completely, and then he opened up the Bible verses, and there, just at random, in each case, and there Jesus was talking about those who have left mother and father and children have received it 100-fold in return. And then he opened up at random the Light of Asia, which is the story of the Buddha. And there the Buddha was just leaving his family. And so opening up these three scriptures at random, he felt it was a confirmation that he must do this. He must renounce the world completely. And so he went out. And normally when you become a Swami, it's another Swami who makes you. So in Master's case, it was Sri Yukteswar. Since Lari Mahasya was not a Swami, when Sri Yukteswar felt inwardly prompted to take on the Swami garb, that Babaji had first proclaimed him a Swami, even though he didn't wear the garb and didn't have the name, went by his family name at the time. But he felt this growing sense, and also there is those who wanted to come to his Gita studies, but didn't feel they could, because he was a Kshatriya caste, and they were Brahmin. And so in order to enable them to come, he decided to take the Swami order out of compassion for them. Because once he became a Swami, then all bets were off, so to speak, around what caste you were born to. Now, they left free for the Brahmins to come, if they wished to his Gita study. And so he took that. He took his vows from another Swami. Lari Mahasya was no longer in the body at the time. Nor could he have technically given it to him. But Papa was a unique case. He went out to the river. He took off his old clothing. He dyed the white clothing with ochre color and put it on. And he left and he took on the name Ram Dass. Now normally you have an ending of Ananda when you become a Swami. But he felt that Ram Dass was his name. That was his new name. Ram meaning God, Dass meaning slave. And so he went from that place and he was chanting continuously the Ram Nam. And it was never from his lips, it was never from his mind. There were a couple occasions where he felt like he had a bit of a falling. There's one point where he was waiting in line with some other Swamis in order to get some food. And it was a place that would feed Swamis on one day, but you weren't allowed to come back again. And there's another Swami who had been there the day before, or a few days before, I don't remember exactly. But anyway, he was hungry and he wasn't allowed to come in. And Ram Dass allowed himself to be swept in with the other Swamis who were allowed to come in. But he remembered that Swami who was outside and who was hungry, and he just felt terrible. And he was eating, but he couldn't hardly eat at all. And then he left that place, and he left it in a daze. Because he felt he had let himself down. He had not had the proper attitude. He shouldn't have taken that food, he felt, because this other man was hungry and was left outside. And he walked as it was in a daze through the town. He felt himself completely out of sync. And he felt terrible. Sri Yukteswar says that those who had attained to the higher astral heavens where he was serving, and when he came back and spoke to Master in a resurrected form, he said those who even make a small mistake in thinking feel tremendous pain as a result, and this was certainly Papa's state at the time. And so he felt such deep regret for having made even this small transgression against his own God consciousness. And so he stayed in like that for several hours, perhaps several days. And gradually he started coming back out of it, and he started feeling the presence of God again in the form of the bliss that was coming up in him. And so this was his strict routine. He wouldn't allow himself any divergence whatsoever. And if we want to go the whole way to God, this is the way that we must be with ourselves. We must have that kind of strictness. Now, if it's all taking something away, if it's all a list of don'ts, without anything to take us up, you see, then it becomes a very dry path. There are those saints and there are those aspirants down through time who have just simply led a very strict life, and they've even gone through extremes of torturing their body. Now, the Buddha did this for 7 years after he left his family, and he practiced the strictest kind of renunciation. He starved the body. We don't know all the different ways. Sometimes we know that these yogis, they'll stare in the sun until they physically go blind. They'll light fires around them and endure intense heat. They'll hold their arms up for so long that they'll atrophy. And they literally torture the body in an attempt to try to transcend the body. And many of them are not successful. There are many swamis who met Papa Ramdas as he walked all over India, and they asked him, how long have you been living this kind of life? And sometimes he would say, 6 months, sometimes a year. And they couldn't believe it, because they'd been practicing for so many years and they didn't experience the bliss that Papa did. They could tell. His face was lit up. His eyes were sparkling. They could tell that he was in the bliss of God. And they didn't have that. And many times he met those who were complete hypocrites. He met the one Swami who is completely addicted to ganja, to a kind of marijuana. And he had gotten his disciple hooked to it too in order to bind him to him. And as they sat outside this temple, this disciple had finally had enough of it, because the guru, so to speak, abused him in so many different ways, and it actually bound him through drugs to himself. And so the disciple said, I'm done with you, and I'm done with this addiction. And in a great show, he left that place, and Papa was so happy because he'd seen this man free himself. Perhaps it was Papa's influence that was subtly and hidden in operation that gave him the courage, the clarity, and the strength to renounce those things and to really go after and seek God. It has been eye-opening to me to see the many paths that people travel. They come to this path. They came to it through Mother. They come through it through this form. And then they are taken up in temptation. Now, we are all tempted. Even Jesus was tempted out in the desert. Even Jesus fell 3 times as he made his ascendancy to the hill of Golgotha, or the hill of the skull. And he fell 3 times, and he needed help at different times. And so we all fall. We all are tempted. And the thing is do we keep our mind on God, or do we allow the temptation to take us over? Here's the thing. You have this higher consciousness, this higher energy that's flowing through you. And in the beginning, we start out in a human state of consciousness, and it's in the 3 lower centers. And in those lower centers is all about being human being. It's all about the survival of this body. It's all about the pleasures of this body. And it's about discovering self-will. And so this is what makes up most people's lives, is in those 3 lower kingdoms. And then we begin to go into the higher centers when this higher energy, this consciousness, this kundalini is awakened inside of us. And we come to the heart center, we come to the throat center, and to the 6th center at the ajna. These higher realms begin to open up before us. And then some temptation comes along because we have lived a life, and in most cases, many, many lives. We have old patterns, we have old tendencies that many times are dormant. We don't even realize that they're there, but someone or something will come along And suddenly our attention is drawn down into the lower centers, but not just in an ordinary way. Because we have these higher energies running through our body, those higher energies are then taken down through these lower centers, and it gives them a heavenly glow. For instance, if we were to meet somebody, perhaps from a previous lifetime, and we felt an attraction for that person, it wouldn't be an ordinary attraction. We would feel that this person was our soulmate. We would feel that this person had an extraordinary amount of spiritual connection with us, because we are guiding that higher energy into the lower centers. That can also happen with any kind of desire nature, or even any kind of fear. Now, in the case of a fear, it activates that fear, but it doesn't give it any heavenly quality. But it gives it a powerful force in our life, so that the higher the energies that we're dealing with, as they rise up the spine and then they're guided down into the lower centers, they become extremely powerful. And we have to be willing to contend with this. Now, we have a delicate balance in here, because we are talking about, you might say, sin. Now, sin in its original meaning and its original word meant missing the mark, like an archer would miss the mark. And it's taken on quite a powerful meaning in the English language. And Mother herself said that being raised in the Catholic Church, that she was told that she was a sinner. And I know of people who were told at such a young age that they were a sinner and they weren't even capable of having a sinful thought. But they thought they must. And I've even heard of people making up things to tell the priest during confession, because they didn't have anything really to tell them, but they thought they ought to. So they made up some sins in order to confess it so that they could be absolved of it. And this is the kind of craziness that can go on. So we don't want to give too much energy to sin. Mother grew up being afraid of God, being afraid of the path, being afraid of that if she made just even one little slip up, that she would be somehow condemned for hell. And that oftentimes gets translated as everlasting. But I'd like to point out here, I think this translation of the unquenchable fire is closer to the mark. It's an unquenchable fire because as long as there's any dross, as long as there's anything of ignorance, as long as there's anything of separation that can be burned, the fire is unquenchable. But it doesn't mean eternal. What kind of sadistic God, and it really would be a sadistic God, who would take any human being, regardless of what they've done in life, and made them suffer for eternity? That just doesn't make any sense. There's no lesson to be learned from that. There's no growth. There's nothing positive about it. And no God that I would worship would ever even think of such a thing. This is so completely manufactured in the mind of man. And oftentimes, disgracefully so, it is done in order to get control over other human beings, to make them fearful. Now, this is absolutely and completely wrong, because fear will never take us all the way to God. Surely we should be made known of the law of karma, and that if we transgress against that law, we will have to pay a price. But you know, we're not always mindful of that. Not at the time, at least. Not until we're having to face them. And then we can deeply regret whatever we've done in order to make that happen. We know this just in simple things. When you think of having that extra piece of cake or extra piece of pie or more ice cream or more pizza or whatever it might be, it tastes very good while it's going down, and yet we know that we're really already full. But we go ahead and we eat that, and then later on we regret it because our stomach hurts, and we just have to go through a period of time where we have to endure that pain for a certain amount of time until it passes. And hopefully, through time, we learn the lesson. I listen to people who are in their 40s, their 50s, their 60s, And they're still talking about going out and getting drunk and having a hangover, for Pete's sakes. Can't they learn even a little bit of self-restraint? That's still going on in their lives so many years later? And so we come to this time when we have these temptations and we have to learn how to withhold. We have to learn how to say no to whatever it is that is tempting us. And sometimes we just have to say it with every ounce of our strength, because that temptation comes in such a powerful way. Now, there's another way of doing it as well, and that is to seek out and look for the original positive intention behind the temptation, because everything that we experience is going back to God. And so if we can identify what that positive intention is, let's say we are tempted with entering into a sexual relationship with someone, and we know we're not married and it's not the right thing to do at the time. And so you identify, what is it that's fulfilled? It's not just sex, of course. There's the pleasure of that. But it's also feeling affirmed, feeling desired, feeling wanted. It's also feeling a close bond, a close union. And if we really analyze it, we can see that deep down underneath, what we're really wanting is we're wanting union with God. We're wanting the bliss of God. But it's getting interpreted through wanting pleasure with an individual. It's wanting to be close, in union with. And yet it cannot promise us lasting happiness. There are definite and serious consequences for us going down that road. And so when we identify what it is that is the positive intention behind that desire, and we get to that place, then we can redirect that positive intention towards God. We can paint a picture, so to speak, of what it is to be in union with God and show it to that part who so desires, who's lonely, who wants that affirmation, who wants that bliss, and show it what's potential in being in union with God. When we do that, we can appeal to the true basic intention behind that desire. And that can change us. It can fulfill that desire by painting that picture of what it's like to be in union with God. Isn't that wonderful? And you can actually use that desire then not to go out and do something against God's law, but you can do it to take all of that energy and direct it towards God. And to find your union with God, and to find the bliss that comes with that, and the deep sense of union and contentment that comes with that. Everything that you desire, that your true heart's desire, will be fulfilled in your union with God. This is the truth. It's the absolute truth. I know it because I've experienced it. And many of us have experienced it, only we experience it for a little bit of time. And the great mystery is how a veil of ignorance can come down around us again. And then we can be lost to the sense of union. We get tempted once again, and all those divine energies get channeled through the wrong nerves. And as a result, we have to make our way back up. I'd like to read here a little bit from Peace Pilgrim's 12-point plan. This is from the New Journal. And I'd like to point out that we've printed this in a new way. And it's all glossy and the pictures are very nice. And I think you'll appreciate the higher quality that is coming with this printing. I think it's wonderful. But this came from Peace Pilgrim. And I met Peace Pilgrim many years ago. I think the year was 1978. It may have been 1979. I was going to college at the time, and she spoke at the college. And this was an amazing saint who walked all over America. She started in the early 1950s, and she wanted to walk for peace. She was concerned about the nature of the Cold War, what was going on in Korea and so forth. And she wanted to do something about it, and she was in a deep prayerful state. She would go for long walks with God. And she asked God, what is my purpose for being here? And finally this clarity came to her. And she felt this vow come up through her that she would walk until given shelter, she would fast until given food, and that she would pray to God always. And so she set out, and she didn't take any money. She's a modern-day Western sadhu. She just wore very simple clothes, some canvas tennis shoes, some cotton socks, pants, a kind of sweatshirt, and then a tunic that went over the sweatshirt that had started out with 10,000 miles for peace, and then she made it 25,000 miles for peace. And in her mind, she saw this map of the United States, and she saw a pathway that went from the south all the way to the west coast and then back again to the east coast to New York. She didn't take any money with her. She is a single woman. I think she is in her early 50s at the time. She may have been late 40s, early 50s. And so she just took off walking like that. And if she would get to some place where she just absolutely had to rest, she would point at some piece of concrete there and she'd tell her body to lay down and go to sleep right there. Now, how many of us, if our pillow isn't just right and if our mattress isn't just so comfy and all the rest, we can't sleep? And here she'd lay down and went to sleep on that piece of concrete. And that she said that she never went more than four meals. She didn't miss any more than four meals before she was given something to eat. By the time that I met her, she was accepting rides because she was getting radio interviews, TV interviews, and so on. And she'd walked over 25,000 miles for peace at that point. She'd walked all over the country and didn't make any difference if it was summer, if it was winter. She was never sick one day from the time that she left on this spiritual journey. Not one day. She was out in all the elements. Can you imagine such a thing? And so what a wonderful individual of faith, and I felt quite privileged that Michael McCurley and I were able to give her a ride to Bellingham. And she told us many stories. And one that stands out to me is that she talked to a woman who was a mother of three young children. And she said, Peace Pilgrim, she said that she went by that name exclusively. She left all of her old life behind her. And she said, Peace Pilgrim, she says, I don't know what to do. She says, sometimes I get so angry at my children. They're yelling and they're screaming. It feels like it's out of control. And then I start yelling and I start screaming and I get out of control and I hate it. But I can't leave them. I can't take a time out. I don't know what to do. And so Peace Pilgrim told her what she should do in such a case. And so later on, the woman reported back to her that she had done exactly what Peace Pilgrim did with perfect results. And when the children were acting out and when they started screaming at each other and she just felt her blood begin to boil, right there in the middle of the living room, she started running in place. And the first thing that happened is all the children stared at her in complete wonder and awe and wondered whether their mother had gone completely insane or not. And she just sat there and ran in place and ran in place, and then the children started to laugh. And then she started to laugh, and it just changed everything for her. And so this is kind of practical, down-to-earth wisdom that Peace Pilgrim was able to give, because she felt this tremendous attunement with God all the time as this inner prayer had become something that was constant. But she talked about this 12-point plan and that there were some purifications that needed to happen. And I'm going to quote here. Then I discovered that there were some purifications required of me. The first one is a simple thing. It is purification of the body. This has to do with your physical living habits. You'd think this might be the first area which people would be willing to work. But from practical experience, I discovered it's often the last because it might mean getting rid of some of our bad habits, and there's nothing we cling to more tenaciously. And this is absolutely true, and so she went on to describe how some of these things that she changed were in her diet, in simplicity of her surroundings, in making everything clean and orderly, and so on. And so she does this purification, all in preparation. These are all in preparation of having peace. Unless you're able to do these things and willing to do these things, then you won't get anywhere. You won't discover that peace. There is a second purification. I cannot stress too much because it is purification of thought. If you realized how powerful your thoughts are, you would never think of a negative thought. There can be a powerful influence for good when they're on the positive side. And they can and do make you physically ill when they're on the negative side. If you're harboring the slightest bitterness toward anyone or any unkind thoughts of any sort whatever, you must get rid of them quickly. They aren't hurting anyone but you. It is said that hate injures the hater, not the hated. It isn't enough just to do the right things and say the right things. You must also think right things before your life can come into harmony. And this is exactly what Krishna was talking about, as I quoted earlier, that those people who control their activities but not their mind are hypocrites. Jesus gave a very exacting bar to get over. He said, in terms of adultery, if you even think of someone who is not your husband or wife in a sexual kind of a way, that is adultery. And some people might think, but that's too much. How can anyone control their mind in such a way? And it would be impossible if grace were not active inside of us, if we did not have that bliss that was lifting us up higher, so that we weren't tempted by the things of the lower nature. We felt that expansiveness. When you become focused on anything of this body or anything of this narrow world, your focus becomes very small, very tiny, because it cramps your soul. It cramps your spirit into a very tiny, narrow band of thought. When you lift your mind up beyond the things of this world, you feel the expansiveness, you feel the upliftment, you feel lighter, you feel bliss, you feel joy, you feel the light of being. If you are not feeling these things, you're not making progress. And it behooves every one of us to really bear down, to really get to business and start to focus upon this so that we might experience that freedom. It's not for anyone else that you do this, although everyone will benefit when you do. But it is for yourself. It is to discover the freedom and that light and that joy that is always flowing to you. And when you keep the doors open, then that will become your experience. There is a third purification, and that is the purification of desire. What are the things you desire? Do you desire new clothing or pleasures or new household furnishings or your new car? You can come to the point of oneness of desire just to know and do your part in the life pattern. When you think about it, is there anything else really important to desire? In other words, we're each given something to do in this life. Each one of us are a unique creation. No one can replace you. You may minimize the role that God has given you in this lifetime, but God does not minimize it. It is something that is important. One of my favorite stories And I think I've told you before, but it came from the movie It's a Wonderful Life. And there was a script that was written out, a short story that was written out before the movie. And in this story that came before the movie, the man who became depressed about his life wasn't the bank president, but he was just simply the teller. And he had children and he had a wife, and he felt very bad that he wasn't making more money and that his life was worth more through his insurance policy than it was through what he was making at the bank. And so that's when he decided to kill himself, and that's when his guardian angel came to show him what life would be like without him. Now, here's just a bank teller in the organizational chain of things. It's pretty much the lowest man on the totem pole. But because he wasn't there, another man who he knew in high school took his place because he had never been born, as the angel showed him. And in that case, this man embezzled money from the bank, and the bank collapsed. And this is the days before there is federal insurance on the banks. And the banks collapsed, and because the bank collapsed, many businesses collapsed as well. And the whole town was boarded up and shut up as a result, because this man was not there to honestly do his job. So you see, it's important what you do. No matter what humble circumstances God gave to you. In a previous journal, we had the story of Brother Andre, who was a wonderful saint, and he's been canonized since, but he was the doorkeeper. He stood at the door and welcomed people in as they came into the church. And he had very simple duties. He was not the archbishop. He wasn't high up in the hierarchy. But he had this tremendous influence. You never know how God will use you and what purpose he's brought you to this earth for. We must be humble. We must be surrendered to God. Now, if you're not doing what God has asked you to do, then you must correct that if you want real happiness. So this is purification of desire, to make your desire only to do God's will. And when that is your desire, when you are completely aligned with God, you see, then if you have a desire come up in you, it will be automatically attuned to God's will. In order to fulfill some function for God, if you need a new car or if you need something added to you, then God will see to it. When you live in that completely surrendered state, my life is a testament to that. For these last many years, I haven't done a job, so to speak, for a salary or anything like that. I've only served God. And as my mother has asked me to do, I haven't charged for anything that I do, and yet God has provided so beautifully for everything that I have. And if I need something, then God brings it, and he often brings me many things I don't need. I can pass it on to other people. And it's beautiful, and it's wonderful, and it's a demonstration of this truth, that when your desire is purified and you feel that you are living in harmony with God's laws and nature's laws, everything will come to you that you need. And so this purification of desire, set aside everything that is not of God. Seek to do God's will only. And then watch him demonstrate in your life how everything that you need comes to you. There is one more purification, according to Peace Pilgrim, and that is purification of motive. What is your motive for whatever you may be doing? If it is pure greed or self-seeking or a wish for self-glorification, I would say, don't do that thing. Don't do anything you would do with such a motive. But it isn't easy, because we tend to do things with very mixed motives, good and bad motives all mixed together. Here's a man in the business world, his motives may be the highest, but mixed with them are motives of caring for his family and perhaps doing some good in his community. Mixed motives. I met a few people who have had to change their jobs in order to change their lives. But I met many more people who merely had to change their motive to service in order to change their lives. And you can tell when your motives get off track. You feel yourself contracting. You feel yourself wanting to protect your ego self. What if somebody finds out that I did something wrong? Or that I made a mistake over here? Well, what if they did? What if it was published on the headlines of the newspapers? And it was out there for everyone to see. Could you just simply say, I was attempting to carry out God's will. Perhaps I fell short. I'm learning from my experience, and I'm getting right back into the spiritual saddle, the sadhana saddle, and I'm getting right back up and going again. And I leave everything behind that is not of God. I don't have to try to protect myself. I don't have to become something that I'm not, or more accurately, I don't have to pretend to become something that I'm not. If you notice the lives of saints, they become very simple in their lives, in their motives. When Papa met Ananda Moima, he had a interesting and delightful interchange with her. And Papa was saying he was just the child of Ananda Moima and of all saints. And Ma said, nothing of the sort. I am your child. And Papa said, no, I am the child. And Papa said, I can prove it. He said, look, I have no hair. I have no teeth. I'm just like a little child. Ma couldn't do anything to top that, so she just had to smile and accept what Papa said. You see, his motive wasn't anything for greatness. Once Ramakrishna was talking to one of the famous actors of the time who was a devotee. And they were talking about a play and what parts they would play in the play and just having fun with it. And then they turned to the master and they said, Master, what part would you like to play in this play? And Ramakrishna looked at this great actor and he said, I would like to play the dust at your feet. And he meant it. He meant it. When we feel that God alone is important and everything else is a subsidiary of that, then we don't have to guard ourselves. We don't have to have mixed motives. And when we sense that perhaps a mixed motive of greed or some other desire nature has come in, then we can notice it and let it go immediately. Let it go. And ask God, what would you have me do in this circumstance? And you know that you are aligning yourself with God when you feel completely calm inside. When you feel his presence, when you don't feel hurried, when you don't feel you have to grasp onto something or you're going to lose it, that's the ego. God may say move and move now, but you still don't have that grasping kind of feeling. You feel you are in the grasp of God, not in the grasp of greed. And that's a completely different experience. And so we purify our motive and are motivated in order to do God's will alone. Mother summed it all up so simply, so brilliantly, so beautifully. Keep your mind on God. To love God, to serve God, to chant God's name, to meditate deeply upon God. Until you merge your little self into God's great being. You see, this is the test. And we can test ourselves any day, at any time of the day. And see, how are we doing? Are we advancing? Are we progressing? Are we feeling that mergence more and more and more? And if we are not, then we need to get busy. We need to get focused. We need to discover where we're going wrong. And begin to set things right. And when you do these purifications, you will be on the road towards discovering real peace. Peace isn't just the cessation of war. There's been many times when there's been cessation of war, but no real peace. Peace is a tangible, quantifiable substance. It is something that you can experience in the depths of your soul, and you know it when you get it. And so not to fool yourselves, just because you're not at war with yourself and just because things are going along pretty well doesn't mean that you've discovered peace. Not in its fullness, not its entirety. So let us strive and strive and strive. As Lari Mahashya said, working, 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 behold, one day the goal. And you are here to do that. And grace is working in you even now. And as you make the conditions for grace more and more right, it's like the yeast inside of the bread that makes it rise. It rises the bread. You've helped create the conditions in which the yeast can be active. It's a spiritual yeast inside your soul. And you'll want God with all of your heart, with all of your mind, with all of your soul, with all of your strength. You'll want God. You'll be positively driven towards Him and attracted to Him. So let us recognize these temptations when they come. And let us keep our mind on God always. And if we do, we'll be drawn to God beyond all temptation. It's a wonderful song that we learned many years ago. May the long time sun shine upon you. I thought it would be nice for us to sing that in closing. May the long time sun shine on you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide you all the way home. May the long time sun shine on you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide you all the way home. May the long time sun shine on you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide you all the way home. May it be so. Pray with me, O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with Thee.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He. Ooh.
bliss. Amen. Pranams. I bow to the divine light within you. May that pure light guide you all the way home.